Okay. So we're in the middle of discussing eating, food, mitzvahs pertaining to eating and food. So before we get into specifics, I have one or two other more general perspectives on food I wanted to share. And then we'll talk more about specific types of food prohibitions. There's a perspective which I read in a sefer from, his name is Rav Shimshon Pinkus. He was an American, lived in Israel, very inspirational speaker. He died tragically in a car accident probably about 12 years ago now. But posthumously they put out a lot of books from his different, he didn't write so much his lifetime, but he gave a lot of speeches. So they transcribed a lot of his speeches and put them into books in the past 10, 12 years. He has a fascinating idea, which I found to be very inspirational in terms of eating. Eating is an experience which, not just eating for a mitzvah. We understand that a Shabbos meal should be an inspiring, uplifting experience. We understand that a Yontif meal, a Purim meal, we understand these should be inspiring experiences that can connect you to God. But how about everyday eating? Even everyday, normal eating experiences should also connect you with God. And how is that? We find a very fascinating thing, which is when Yitzchak is ready to give the blessings to his children. So Esav comes in, and he was the one who the blessing was intended for initially. So Yitzchak tells Esav, before I'm ready to bless you, go out, aseli matzavim, go out and prepare for me delicious delicacies that I like, bring them to me and I'll eat them, so that my soul can bless you. So Yitzchak wanted to have a nice, delicious meal that he would enjoy to prepare himself to bless Esav. Now blessing, especially for someone on Yitzchak's level, blessing is a very spiritual experience. He needed to connect with God. There seems to be some form of prophecy or holy inspiration coming within him to bless his children. And the way to prepare for that was through eating. So how is the eating the preparation for such a spiritual, sublime experience of tapping into holy inspirations and blessing children? It's simple.
Yeah. What do you think?
Energy. Okay, but so you could have had a granola bar. He tells him, go for energy, you can eat anything. He said, go out and prepare for me the most delicious foods that I know, my favorite foods. Okay, but what would be the connection between the two? I don't know, it's just energy.
It's a good quality meal, good meat, so it can have better spiritual force.
Okay, but what's the link between the good meat and the spiritual force? That's the question. So eating is itself a very intense moment spiritually. Why? Because that's one point in our day where we should actively feel God infusing us with life. You know, we all feel that, we don't eat, we get weak, we get hungry, we get tired, we get headaches, and we feel the difference if we're not eating well. So you sit down for a meal, you take a bite, a few minutes later you feel strong, you feel alive, you feel strengthened, your headache goes away, you're ready to go out and conquer the world now. You just needed to have that one meal. And so we can look at it as this, okay, so food gives us nutrition helps us function. But ultimately, that's how God infuses life into the human being daily. The fuel comes from Hashem. As the Torah tells us, "Ki lo lechem levad yichya adam." We don't live on bread alone. It says, "Ki al kol motzei Hashem yichya adam." We live based on the mouth of Hashem. And yes, it's through our food. Through this cup of water, I'm receiving inspiration. I'm receiving life from Hashem. Through a bagel, through whatever I eat, I'm receiving life from Hashem. So we sit down to eat because we enjoy the food, because we need the strength. So that's just having a normal meal. That's very mundane. If we just put it in the perspective that this is the way through which God has given me life. At this point, I'm connecting with God in a very intense way because right now I'm receiving life from God Himself. That could flip around the eating experience to a whole new level. We're granted new strength from heaven when we eat. That's how we should view eating. So beyond that, so we have this aspect of the food giving us strength, giving us the life straight from God into our bodies. That's what the food is doing. The second level, which is, we know that eating is a pleasure. We enjoy good food. It's one of the pleasures of life. And it didn't have to be that way. I mean, Hashem, we all breathe, right? Breathing is also a necessity in life. We don't have a pleasure out of breathing. I mean, God forbid, if someone has breathing problems and they take a breath, it feels good and it's necessary. But there's no desire to have air. There's no inherent pleasure in breathing. We just breathe. We breathe because we have to breathe and finish. Food, it could have been that way. It could have been that God created the world where food was the same thing as air. So you have to eat food, but not that it tastes good. Not that it smells good, not that it looks good, not that we enjoy it. It would just be another necessity of life, like anything else. It could have been that way. And Hashem can create the world if he wants. It doesn't matter. Whatever Hashem wants, the way he creates the world. So the world could have been that eating was like breathing. That would be the comparison I would make. And just like we don't have a specific pleasure out of breathing, we don't have a pleasure out of eating. But yet Hashem made it that food, eating is an enjoyable experience. Food has variety, food has taste, food has color, food has texture. You can have it hot, you can have it cold, you can have it spicy, you can have it sweet. There's so many different ways we can enjoy food. At different times, we do it different ways, and it's so much is added to our experience because of all the beauty and all of the variety Hashem places the world when it comes to eating. We have taste buds. We don't need to have taste buds. That's why did Hashem give us taste buds? But He wants us to be able to taste the food and enjoy the food. It's all pleasure from Hashem. Rav Victor Miller, I believe, was quoted to explain that in the first paragraph of benching, we say, Hazanas olam klo b'tuvo, Hashem sustains the world, the entire world, in His goodness, b'chein, in His grace, b'chesed, in His kindness, v'rachmimet, in His mercy. So the mercy and sustaining the world we understand, because without food we couldn't live. There's mercy involved. But the kindness and the grace in giving us food, the grace in the food, the beauty of food, is its variety, is the textures, is the colors. I mean, food could have also just been all brown mush. Maybe the only edible thing for human being would have been brown mush. Maybe Hashem could have made the world that way. Tasteless brown mush. Cardboard. Whatever. But we eat it because we had to. But Hashem made many foods, many varieties, many tastes, and they look pretty. Not only do they taste good, foods have a visual draw to them. Yeah, the apple has a shiny red, you have oranges, every single food has its own color, its own specific way in which it draws us in and pleases us. If you ever eat in the dark, it's not the same experience either. Seeing the food actually helps enjoy our food. Smell also, the smell of the food, if you hold your nose and eat, it's also not the same experience as we know. Because everything comes together. The food smells good, it looks good, it tastes good, and all that together creates a very pleasurable experience. So to understand that eating is a time that we can truly appreciate Hashem's kindness to the world, the beauty of Hashem's world, Hashem's kindness to us in giving us pleasures, and affording us all this goodness, it also can transform into a very spiritual experience. It doesn't take long. I mean, we sit down, we eat the food, but we sit down and think for 1 second, I'm about to receive life from God. I'm about to enjoy God's world. So it's very different than just starting to eat. We have brachos. You know, Hashem, there's a rule that we have to make a bracha before and after eating. Some are Torah mandated, some are rabbinic. But the point of a bracha is to focus us in on the fact that eating should be a way to connect to God, to recognize the source of the food, to appreciate the food, to appreciate where the food's coming from, and as we said, to appreciate the variety of the food, the beauty of the food, and the grace within the food, the taste of the food. That's all part of it. So even if we didn't enjoy the food, we'd still make a blessing because it's still giving us life. That's the very most. That's the most basic level of the blessing. But it's supposed to tie us into God. Eating is a very spiritual experience. Now, as it goes, there's a famous quote. It's quoted from Nachmanides, the Ramban, but it applies in so many ways. The more holy something has potential to be, the least holy we make it. So, such as eating as an experience, it can be a very sublime, uplifting, holy experience. But that gives it the potential to go the other direction as well. It can be also a very animalistic and very physical experience. It can go both ways. Because the more potential something has to be great and spiritual and sublime, it gives it the more potential to become more lowly and animalistic and physical and of that nature. So one way we can flip our eating experience into a very spiritual experience, so if we focus on the blessings we make before and after eating, that should tie us into the fact that eating is receiving God's kindness and God's life force into our lives. It turns eating from an animalistic urge, an instinct, into a very spiritual experience. We make it into a human experience rather than an animalistic experience. That's what we do. And eating can become something which is most animalistic or most human, depending on how we approach eating. It can go both ways. It's two sides of the same coin. I'll make my bracha. Taking the life force for God. But it's also how we frame the experience. We frame the experience in a way that this is how I connect with God. That's one type of eating. If we frame it that I'm hungry and I'm fulfilling my desires, that's a different type of eating. And the difference can be in 5 seconds of thought. That's the difference can lie. But as long as if we frame it in the right way, it can become a way that connects us constantly with God. Every time I take a bite, I understand I'm receiving life from God right here in my sandwich, right here in my water, right here in my cereal. Whatever I'm eating, I'm receiving life straight from God. There's a story, I forgot, I've heard it quoted in a few different ways, I don't know which Rebbe it's quoted from, but whether the story is true or not, whichever Rebbe it is, it's irrelevant, the message is the same message. And the story goes that there was a layman, I'm with the Rebbe. And the layman says to the Rebbe, I don't understand. People make a big deal about your blessings. But we both do the same thing. I have an apple, I make a blessing, I eat the apple. You have an apple, you make a blessing, you eat the apple. What's the big difference between the two? So the Rebbe said there's a major difference. You know this story. You know. This is a major difference. Because how does it work for you? You're hungry, you want an apple, you know you can't eat the apple without a blessing, so you make the blessing, eat the apple. For me, my goal is I want to recognize God. Now I know to recognize God, I need to have something to recognize God with, so I go out and get an apple and make a blessing. So it's the same apple and the same blessing, but what's your intent? Is your intent that I'm going to use the apple to connect to God? Because really my ultimate goal is the blessing, not the apple. Or is my goal the apple, and the blessing just in my way before I eat the apple? You know, that was the message of the story. I think I've heard the story in a few different ways, but the message is all the same message.
It's like eating spinach.
When you're not hungry. Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't feel like it, but you say, I'll do it for the blessing. There's a price to do it for the blessing.
Right.
And you don't really want the food.
I've actually seen that really quoted in commentaries pertaining to the Malava Malka meal after Shabbos. After Shabbos, let's say you had all three meals, you're stuffed. Then there's mitzvah to have another meal, have your Malava Malka. So they say it's a very spiritual meal because no one's hungry. You're eating anyways. You know, it is a very spiritual meal.
Especially if you
eat. Yeah, right. Let's put it all together. You're really stuffed. So it's all the same eating experience, but I think it's all how we frame the experience. So when Yitzchak said, I'm ready to give blessings to my children, let me eat first. Yitzchak understood that one of the most direct and easy ways to connect spiritually is through eating. Give me delicious food. I'll understand and appreciate where the food's coming from. I'll understand and appreciate the beauty and the kindness in the food. I'll understand how the food gives me my life, gives me my energy. And that connects me very intensely with God. Now I'm ready to give you blessings. And that's why Yitzchak Avinu knew that that's how they connect. Now we don't eat in the same way he ate. So therefore we don't always feel so spiritually connected. But the idea that eating is, everyday eating is a very spiritual experience, or at least could be if we frame it that way, is a very powerful thought. So that's another general perspective on eating overall. So after that, I'd like to get into some specific mitzvot, specific prohibitions of eating, of kosher eating. You know, what are the specific things Torah talks about? Remember last week we discussed that some of the meanings behind the mitzvahs of eating are based on physical health, emotional health, and spiritual health. Also, we know eating is a very spiritual experience that we described today, so all that together comes as a background to understanding the prohibitions upon certain foods that we're allowed to eat and some foods we're not allowed to eat in the Torah. So I'm going to try to go through a bunch of specifics this week, next week, God willing. I'd like to begin with the prohibition of eating a trefa. Now, colloquially, we use the term treif to mean anything non-kosher. That's not accurate. The word treif in the Torah, trefa in the Torah, is a very specific form of non-kosher food, which is an animal that has a life-threatening injury. That's a trefa. An animal that has an injury, which the rabbis understand will kill the animal within 12 months. Even if you slaughter that animal appropriately with a kosher slaughter, it's a kosher animal. The animal is forbidden to eat. That's an official treifa. The word treif has become the slang for anything non-kosher. But an official treifa in the Torah means this animal that has an injury, which will take its life in 12 months, based on the understanding of Chazal. And therefore, no matter what you do, you slaughter the animal totally 100% appropriately, the animal is still not kosher.
Injury or how about illness?
Injury, not an illness. Illness
not
is different.
So lungs, yeah. Spot on the lungs. That wouldn't be a treifa.
Well, let me reframe that. An illness that actually has a physical blemish to the animal would be a trefa. But if it has some sort of virus or something, let's say, an infection, that'd be different. But if there's a physical blemish which will kill it within 12 months, that's considered a trefa. Right. If the illness caused the lung to have a deformation on it, then there's a physical representation to it. That's to be a physical difference. No, it could be many things. The lung is actually the most common. Broken legs, a lot of things. It depends on what it is. It has to be something that would kill the animal. So, and there's a whole list of them. And there's 72 different types of trefos, I believe.
But how do we know that a broken leg is going to kill them in a year? I know that's why you don't, but I didn't realize that was the reason. Is it something that could kill them within the year?
Right. So that was the tradition that the rabbis had, and they said all these animals become tref. Again, I don't know if the broken leg in particular will kill them, but there's a concern maybe it will pierce something else in the body. There's other concerns as well. Right, well, because the animal can't really function once it has broken limbs either, right?
This is a special question. These are special questions. What's going to kill an animal?
Right. But there's a tradition in the hands of the rabbis of the Mishnah and the Talmud of what we consider treifa, and that's what we go with. So that's an official treifa. Literally, I'll read it to you just so we can understand the source of it all. It's a verse in Parshas Mishpatim. That's where it comes from. And the verse says, here it is. Ache kodesh kodesh tiyumi. You should be a holy people to me. Uvasar besade trefa. Torn meat in the field. Lo sochelu, you shall not eat. Makel tashlichu, so throw it to the dog. That's what the verse says. So literally, trefa refers to a torn animal. Animal was attacked by another animal. That's the literal meaning of the verse. Let's say a wolf came and attacked your sheep, and the sheep now is injured in a way it's going to die. So that's the literal meaning of the verse. The word trefa literally means torn. That's what it means, torn apart. That's the literal meaning. The rabbis tell us, though, it doesn't specifically mean that. No matter how it got the injury, it doesn't matter. If it fell off the roof, if it tripped, whatever it was, if it tripped over a rock, if something else hit it, it doesn't matter if it was torn by another animal or not. Either way, that's considered a trefa, and that renders it non-kosher. That's the verse. In a practical sense, the shochet, when he slaughters the animals, he has to check over for signs of trefa. Now, typically, for most trefas, we're not concerned with unless we see something strange happening to the animal. He doesn't check everything. Because you don't have to be concerned that maybe the animal has an injury unless you see some sort of sign that makes you a little bit curious. The one thing that the shochet does check is the lungs. The most common sign of trefa is in the lungs. So shochet will run his hands over all the lungs after he kills every single animal. Which doesn't sound so pleasant in our mind. That's what they go through, you know? You should know that people who make our meat kosher do some pretty grueling jobs to do it. So we should really appreciate these people. I mean, the shochet himself has a tough job. He checks over an animal. He reaches his hand inside all the animals and check things. And then there's people who pull out all the forbidden veins and fats. It's another terrible job. So we should definitely appreciate those who do these jobs for us so we are able to eat kosher meat. I went to a slaughterhouse once, and there was an elderly man with his son. The man, I think, was from Romania. And he was trained in Romania, I guess, by the community there to pull out all the forbidden veins and arteries and fats in an animal. So this man and his son would sit basically, in, I think it was a refrigerator or freezer, the entire day, in gloves and coats, pulling out veins from animals. And it sounds like it's such a difficult job.
I know why our meat is so expensive.
But someone has to do it, yeah, right, you know? So we got to appreciate these people. Someone's got to do it. We want to eat meat, or else we don't have any meat to eat. So I have to appreciate those people who go through these tough jobs to give us our kosher meat. But the shochet, so he will check the lungs of the animal that he slaughters. Everything else he won't check unless he sees some reason to check it.
Is a person like that, they have to be Jewish?
They have to be Jewish. They don't have to be Jewish, but they have to be supervised by a Jew to make sure what's happening is okay. You could have non-Jews also pulling out those veins, because it's just, you know, you have to know what to pull out, that's all. But you would need your supervisor to make sure that he doesn't cut any corners, you know, because if you fear God, you're not going to want to leave a vein in the animal, which is not kosher. What?
Make sure they don't cut.
Oh. There's no pun intended. We can make it into a pun. But the so we spoke last week about the different, you know, meanings behind kosher animals, and obviously understand that an injured animal may carry with it some disease, may carry with it some unhealthy. That's a sign that either it is unhealthy or will become unhealthy if we don't do something, you know, to heal it. So that we can understand that reason. And again, we also said that every animal which is non-kosher does have its emotional and spiritual effects on the person. So in terms of the actual specific reason for a trefa, I think we can put it into the general categories we discussed last week. But there is one interesting point. It's an aside, but I saw it as a fascinating point, which you find concerning the mitzvah of trefa. If you listen carefully to the verse we read, it says you should be a holy people. Meat that's torn in the field you shall not eat. You should throw it to the dog. So why are we throwing it to the dog? Why is the Torah telling us specifically throw it to your dog? So Rashi tells us one reason. Rashi says that there's a famous verse when the Jews left Egypt that says that the dogs didn't bark that night. So every object in God's world deserves its fair reward. So since the dogs remain tame on the night of the Exodus, therefore their reward is they get to eat our trefas. That's That's what Rashi says.
Something about
Pesach
also about if a dog won't eat it, it's not
chometz
or something.
Yeah, right. So we also use a dog as kind of our
If a dog won't eat it,
then it's not chometz, right. And then we could have it. We can't eat it, but we could at least own it. I would recommend eating that. But, yeah. Yeah, the dog is used kind of as our benchmark. Is this considered food or not? Well, dog eat it, it's food. If only it's not food. That's what we do use dog for that. But I saw another explanation given, which I thought was a very powerful lesson. You know, the case of the Torah literally is a case where an animal came and attacked your flock and injured some of your flock. So who was watching the flock at the time? The shepherd dog. The shepherd and the shepherd dogs. You know, you have your German shepherds, you have your shepherd dogs. They're watching the flock. And they failed. You know what happened? The wolf came, attacked the sheep. The dog may have tried to defend the sheep, but it did succeed, and the sheep were killed. The sheep were injured. So the dog was attempting to do a job, but he failed at his job. So the Torah says this is actually an explanation given by the Dasikim Balitosvos, one of the great commentaries in the Torah. He says that don't be ungrateful. Your dog was your loyal dog for all these years. He dedicated himself to guarding your flock. He may have even gotten in the way of that wolf. And maybe he got hurt in the battle. Maybe not. But just because a person makes one mistake doesn't mean that you write them off and say, you're good for nothing, get out of here. The dog gets to eat the trefa. The Torah says even though it may be his mistake is why the animal became a trefa, either way, let him eat it. Because he's your faithful dog, he's dedicated, he is determined to help you out typically. This is your good shepherd dog. So make sure that one mistake that doesn't ruin the relationship. That's the message. So there's an important lesson that we all have. You know, a person makes one mistake. It could be a big mistake. This could have been a big financial loss for the shepherd. Maybe 50 sheep were all ruined, and now they have to be sold as non-kosher meat. You know, that's a lot cheaper than kosher meat, as we know. Right? So it could cause a big financial loss. Okay, so I mean, I guess we draw a line. If he's a lousy shepherd dog, we could fire him. You know, but the fact that the dog made this one mistake, don't focus on that one mistake. You shouldn't dwell on a person's one mistake. A person's loyal to you. A person's a good friend, a person's a family member who's always doing what they can for you. A person fails one time. So don't rub it in their face. Don't reject them. Don't get upset at them. And rather the opposite. You know, if there's something which is out of it, they still deserve reward because he tried. He tried his best. He's dedicated. So take care of your dog. That's the message you get from this. Everyone makes mistakes at some point. You have to look at their past and future devotion. Don't look at that one mistake which was made. You know, give that trefa to that very trefa which the dog caused. Let him eat the trefa that day. That's the message to us. And obviously, the dog doesn't have emotions or feelings in the same sense a human being does. But it's a lesson for us. It teaches us that this is how we have to interact people as well. A lot of times, we'll have a person who is a good friend of ours, and one time they make a mistake, maybe a big mistake. We get very upset with them, and it kind of puts a whole wrench in the relationship. But the Torah is saying, you know, a mistake is a mistake. You know, people make mistakes. Dogs make mistakes. Everyone makes mistakes. And just look past it. Look at the future. Look at the past. Don't get caught. Don't get caught on one mistake. That's the message here. So it's an aside in terms of our discussion. But that's when the Torah tells you, give the dog the trefa. That's teaching us how to be grateful to those who are our dedicated helpers, even though they might make mistakes at times. That's our part of the message. So that was a beautiful lesson, important lesson to take from it. Next. So that's the prohibition of trefa. There's another prohibition which is related. This is actually much later in the Torah, but we'll discuss it because it's related to trefa. It's called nevela. A nevela is if an animal, a kosher animal, is killed not by a kosher shechita. So a trefa could have had 100% kosher slaughter, but yet because it has this physical blemish, it's still rendered non-kosher. A nevela is an animal which is killed or died but not as a result of a kosher slaughter. That's a nevela. That's also forbidden. Which is why we have to have a kosher slaughter. You can't knock it in the head, you can't shoot it, you can't take roadkill, you can't go hunting and eat the animal. Because all of these ways of killing it are not the kosher slaughter, and that becomes a nevela. That's considered a nevela. Which also brings us to the mitzvah of shechita. There is a mitzvah, a positive command in the Torah to slaughter an animal appropriately, give it a kosher slaughter. A kosher slaughter means that, you know, there's a lot of laws that apply to it, but the simple understanding of kosher slaughter is you have a very sharp knife, and you not non-serrated, so it goes through smoothly, and you're cutting through the esophagus and the trachea, basically in one shot. That's the basic understanding of kosher slaughter. And the reasons that the early commenters explained why we have to give an animal kosher slaughter. So the most well known and understood reason is because it's a humane way of killing an animal. It's supposed to be a quick and easy death, reduce its pain. There's some governments out there that might disagree with that, as we know it does happen that shechita gets prohibited in some countries, unfortunately. But that's what the Rambam tells us. The Rambam tells us, Rambam was also a well-known doctor, so maybe we can trust him in terms of the medical advice as well. He was a veterinarian, he's a doctor, but probably in those days it was probably one of the same, I assume. But the Rambam says is a quick and easy way to reduce the pain of an animal. We have to kill it, we're allowed to eat it, but this is the Torah says, kill it in a way which is a humane, which reduces the animal's pain. It's actually a fascinating thing. You know, you go back 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, in the early times of the Torah, really until the past century, there's no concept, there's no such thing as animal rights. There's no concept of, there's no pita. None of these concepts existed. You know, your animal was your property, you didn't do what you wanted to do to it, and finish. Nobody cared if you hurt an animal, besides the Torah. The Torah, already 3,500 years ago, when Hashem gave the Torah has a concept within it called Tsar Balei Chayim, not to cause pain to animals. So the Torah really originated the concept of animal rights, which far preceded the rest of the world, by far. I mean, I don't know the exact history, but I'm sure, I don't think in general culture that became an issue until the past 50 years, 100 years at most. You know, it could be there was something before, but we need to do the research. But the Torah does predate animal rights by many thousands of years.
I think in the 1900s when Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
And he exposed the horrors of...
So that's when animal rights really started to come out.
Yeah, 150 years or so.
There's methods in which we do it.
How does a non-kosher slaughter go?
I don't know if they slaughter. I don't know if they electrocute or they... I'm not sure what they do. I'm not really sure what they do for non-kosher meats.
They electrocute them in the brain.
They electrocute them? Yeah, they zap it somehow. You know, they knock it and they zap it.
The animal
animal has to be held still when you're doing a kosher slaughter, because you don't want it moving around to mess up the slaughter. So there are different ways they do it. So the people do object to the idea of hoisting it upside down, because that causes a lot of distress to the animal prior to death. So there is out there in the world people who object to kosher slaughter based on the hoisting done beforehand. They're not all hoisted upside down that way either. It depends on the point you're going to. It depends on what kind of animal. But that's not actually part of the shechita process. That's just a practical way to get the animal still to do the shechita. Actual shechita is a quick, easy. You know, it's extremely quick. I went to a slaughterhouse and I watched. It's a very quick process. I mean, you've seen it. Yeah, it's a very quick process. So the Rambam says it's all in order to have a quick, easy process to reduce the pain of the animal. And this ties into the concept. I didn't meat afterwards. So some people wouldn't, and I would. There's two responses. Either you're hungry for meat, or you won't eat meat. One of the two. So I think I was hungry for meat afterwards.
You
know. The concept's called Tsar Balei Chayim. That's the concept. The Torah has many different locations in the Torah where it does seem to be concerned for the welfare of the animal, such as shechita is one example. One example is unloading the burden from an animal which is overloaded. That's the most famous example. And then the Gemara cites it as a general principle in Judaism, Tsar Balei Chayim, that you should not cause undue pain to animals. That's the general principle which is cited in the Gemara.
And also on Shabbat, you're not allowed to trap an animal to,
Right.
I mean, even to inside your... Your home.
Right. That's really for other reasons, but it's true. That's for other reasons also. Shooing away the mother to take the eggs.
Also,
right.
Also, there's something about plowing. You're not supposed to put a mule and a horse to plow next to each other.
Right.
Because one can go is stronger and can go faster.
Right. You can't muzzle an animal while it's plowing either. You have to muzzle the animal as it's going to work for you so it can eat. Yes, there's a lot of places where there's sensitivity to animals. That's for sure. So it's always interesting to think how the Torah has this principle thousands of years ago, where in modern society only came up in recent centuries at best. So that's one reason given for kosher slaughter. That's from the Rambam. The Sefer HaChinuch describes another, it's a practical halachic reason, which is that we'll discuss, God willing, in future weeks, there's a prohibition of eating blood. And the kosher shechita process draws out a lot of blood. In the process, this makes it easier to kosher the animal overall from the blood. And it is a bloody process, so I'll tell you that.
But it's wonderful now that you go to the butcher and it's already kosher.
It's all done, yeah.
I remember my mom doing it.
The pail and water.
Right,
salt.
Yeah. Big mess, right? Now it's all done for us.
That's why meat is so expensive.
Because they do everything for us beforehand.
Yeah.
Right. So that's part of it might be the actual shechita itself removes a lot of the blood initially, so there's less blood to take out in the koshering process. Another commentary, the Ralbag, he explains that it's not just for the sake of the animal, but to teach us not to be cruel. I mean, there's an idea of Tsar Bali Chayim applying to animals. We want to make sure the animal doesn't have undue pain. But ultimately, it's supposed to reflect upon us, that we should learn to be sensitive people. And we walk around killing and knocking animals and stepping on bugs and doing things like that. Even, let's say, we're concerned for the animal's pain. Let's say it's an instant death. But if we just kill ruthlessly like that, it's not good for our own personal midos, because we become cruel people. You have to be sensitive to everything around you, because it changes your sensitivity. So for instance, you know, a lot of the modern authorities discuss, let's say, talk about hunting, kinojuku hunting. So it could be technically, according to the strict halacha, maybe since you're doing it for your own enjoyment, that's not considered undue pain to the animal, maybe technically you could do it. A lot of authorities point out, though, it's terrible for a person's midos to go hunting, because just you're making killing into a sport, and you become a killer. And even though, God forbid, maybe you're never going to kill a person, but it takes its toll on a person's sensitivity, it's a person's midos. Because what we do, even if it's done in a halachically appropriate ways, is it can still affect who we are and how we feel towards other things. It takes a toll on our sensitivity. There's a famous question posed, I think it was posed to Rav Moshe Feinstein, about stepping on bugs. Can we step on bugs? So Rav Moshe says that certainly if the bug is bothering you, it's in your home, you could kill it. But for some of us to walk around outside the sidewalks and smashing bugs, it's bad for a person's sensitivities. You're killing a living being. So even though the bug may die instantly and not feel it, and there's no issue with Tsar Bali Chayim involved, but still, it's not good for you. Because you're going to become a person who's less sensitive to blood, to death, to hurting other beings. Even if you wouldn't do it to a person, but it takes a toll on the person's midos. That's what Moshe Feinstein says. So, yeah.
I know there's a halacha, you're not supposed to give live animal, if we have an animal, we can crickets.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to do it on Shabbos, you're not allowed to kill the bug.
Right, right.
So, like, we have to put that in water or anything. Oh, no, I'm sorry, you have to have it eat crickets.
Oh.
Can't
feed the crickets
on Shabbos.
Yeah.
You can't kill an animal on Shabbos.
Right.
So is that like the same type of source?
Well, not killing the animal on Shabbos, is that what I was saying before? Is a different source for that. That's to do with the 39 Rabbi Melachos of Shabbos. That's a different discussion. Not necessarily sensitivity towards the cricket. But that's a different reason. But then, on a similar vein, there's an interesting mitzvah in the Torah. If there's a city where most of the people have worshipped idols, so Yerni Dachas is called. So the Torah says they're supposed to demolish the entire city, kill out all the people in the city who worship idols. But the Torah then says that Hashem will give you mercy and make you merciful right after that. So the famous commentary Or HaChaim points out that even though killing out the city of idolaters is a mitzvah, you're doing God's will, but still you're a killer. And if you've killed human beings, that can make you a very insensitive person, even if you're doing it for a good reason. So God guarantees in that situation that I'm going to give you an extra measure of mercy within yourself so you still remain sensitive and merciful even though you've gone through a process of killing human beings. That's what the Torah says right there. So the Torah is recognizing that even killing for a good cause still can make you insensitive to death. And therefore, Hashem guarantees, at least in that situation, that if you're going to kill for the sake of a mitzvah, which you need to do, I'm going to make sure you have an extra measure of mercy within yourself so you don't become insensitive and you don't become a cool person. And you could probably extend that to somebody who has to fight a war and doing it for the right reason has to kill. Yeah. You could extend it to any other mitzvah of the Torah where killing, you know, there's death penalties in the Torah. So all these situations, the person has to kill a human being. It could really, even if it's for the right cause, it could take a toll on a person. People come back from war and a lot of times they're very emotionally distraught. We all know that. And what they did was the right thing to do and they're brave and we encourage it. Because it has to be done. On the other hand, you know, it can hurt a person emotionally. I just killed a human being. God, you know, God forbid. It's a very difficult thing to do. So the Torah, in that situation of the Yerhani Dachas, of the city of idolaters, guarantees that you're going to be given by God extra sensitivity so that the killing of those people doesn't affect your personal midos. That's what it says there. I think we can apply it across the board. It's an important concept. Even doing things which might be halakhically permissible, maybe, you know, stepping on a bug, could be we can't find a prohibition of stepping on a bug, killing instantly without any pain. But it's not good for a person's personal mythos, personal character, because every time you step on a bug, you've killed a living being. And the more you kill living beings, the less sensitive you become to other living beings. So that's part of the lessons of Shechita. One more point made, and we'll close with this, is that the mitzvah of Shechita, of slaughtering the animal in a halachic way, so the Ralbag also points out that the fact that there's such precise rules in halachas of how to kill an animal, it focuses the shochet himself on fulfilling God's will rather than on the killing itself. So along the same veins we're discussing, the shochets, I mean, these people who are shochetim, they might kill hundreds of animals a day. You know, over and over again. I mean, they check their knife, they wash it, they do it again. It's a job where they're focusing on killing. That's the job. Again, it's a needed job, and it's a mitzvah, and or else we couldn't eat meat or chicken. But the person is constantly killing. So giving him a whole slew of halachas, which he has to be constantly thinking about as he slaughters the animals, makes him focus, rather than on the killing, he focuses on God and God's commandments. So it flips this act of necessary killing into a spiritual experience of connecting with God, rather than a killing experience, an experience of death and blood. That's the difference. So the shochet's mind, rather than on killing living beings, his mind is on, am I fulfilling the halachas properly? And therefore, as he's doing it, he's not becoming a cruel person, he's not associating himself with death and killing, rather associating himself with God and mitzvos. That's another point that the Ralbag makes. So the precise shechita gives him a focus. So it's not only that he's killing in a humane way, but it's focusing him in on God's commandments every step of the way. That's why he has such precise halachas of shechita. It is an art. It's a precise. You have to, you know, it takes physical strength. It takes a good knowledge of halachas. It takes the fear of God to make sure you did it right. If you don't do it right, the animal is no longer kosher, and you have to tell your boss, "I'm sorry, this animal can't be sold as kosher meat anymore." But then when I went to the slaughterhouse, I went to one in downtown Baltimore. It actually had two sides. There was the kosher side and non-kosher side. So if there was a shechita which was messed up, or the animal was rendered a trefa, they would send it to the non-kosher side to sell it as non-kosher meat. So for the owner of that slaughterhouse, I guess either way he's able to sell it for profit. But I guess the kosher meat's worth more, so I don't know. But if there was a second side to the slaughterhouse, they'd send it over there if the animal was rendered non-kosher. Any questions?
I remember the chickens.
Yeah.
So I don't remember how they did it, though. I remember that, you know...
Or do they?
1995.
It's different than a behemoth, isn't it?
It's pretty much the same.
Really?
Pretty much the same. Yeah.
Well, who does that?
Yeah, same shochet. Yeah, shochet.
I wasn't asking.
I mean, the different training. A shochet which shechs chickens is a different training than one who shechs cows.
What I was asking is, I know how they did it, but like we were talking about the animals, and you're talking about I don't remember with the chicken.
Uh-huh. I don't know what's typical. What I saw